Go.
My name is Eliana Paniagua, and today I am interviewing Dale Barnstable, who served during World War II. I'm here with Devin Baker, Adil Ahmed, Emily DeCornu, and Jerry Barnstable. Today is July 27th. We are recording this interview in Louisville, Kentucky, in Mr. Barnstable's home. Today we will be discussing his experiences during World War II. Dale, can you start out by telling me when you were born and where did you live?
Okay, well, I was born in Wisconsin, and I lived for the first 18 years in northern Illinois. Excuse me. A very small town up there called Antioch. Antioch was a name after the one in Syria. And the town was so small that the sheriff has a town drunk not to leave because the population would go to zero. That's pretty far down. Anyhow, Antioch, Illinois was where I grew up and went to high school and then graduated from there. And immediately I was drafted into the military.
Wow. And who were your family members while you were growing up?
Did I what?
Who were your family members while you were growing up?
While I was growing up, I had a brother that was in the town, and he was in work for as an accountant for a hardware store. My uncle Bill Williams owned the store, and my mother was a waitress up there. Back in those days, everybody had to have a job. We didn't have any money. It was depression time. And so if you had a job and you made money, well, you were pretty well off compared to somebody else. Anyhow, I went to Antioch High School for 4 years, and I played football and basketball and made All-State in those sports. And then I got drafted in 43. And I got drafted by the Selective Service Act, I guess they called it, at Great Lakes, and I went over there and was interviewed. And when I got through with the interview, the guy said, I'm gonna put you in the Navy. And I said, hold it. He said, what do you mean hold it? You're gonna put you in the Navy. I said, I can't go in the Navy. Why not? I said, because I get seasick looking at Lake Michigan. And he said, seasick looking at Lake Michigan? Well, okay, I'll put you in the Army. So that's how I wound up in the Army. And now I went in the Army for 3 years.
Do you remember any of the questions that they asked you during the draft process?
Nothing of any consequence, no. There was the typical questions about where'd you go to school and you graduate and stuff like that. The Selective Service Act was basically to get people into the military because we were about to engage in a war in Europe. And that's the reason I was drafted. If I'd had a choice, I would not have been drafted. But I didn't have a choice. So I can't remember any particular questions. They did not know my educational background necessarily. I mean, back then, it was not as critical as it is today, maybe. But anyhow, when I went into the service, then I was placed in the Army, and I was sent to Texas, to Camp Walters, Texas, which was not the end of the world, but when you got there, you could see it. And so that was down near Fort Worth.
Can you describe what basic training was like?
Basic training was sounds basically kind of repetition, was to be able to orient you to the necessary things that went on in the military and taught you discipline. If there's one thing you needed to know, you had to be on time, you had to get up early, and you had to subscribe to all the rules and regulations that the Army had. So 20-mile marches were customary. In Fort Worth, Texas, in the summertime, the heat was awfully bad. And so a lot of times the guys would pass out on those marches. I remember that. But that was the military wasn't out to do an educational system. They were out to train you with the military, with the rifles you had, and with the necessary stamina to be able to do marches and go places. Mm-hmm. And so, anyhow, so much for that. Yeah. Now, excuse me, let me just say, I went from Fort Worth, Texas, to Camp Maxey, Texas, which is in the eastern part of the state. It's still hot. And then from there, the 71st Division, which was the division I was assigned to, we were sent to Hunter Liggett Military Reservation in California to learn how to fight in the mountains. And the mountains fighting was very, very difficult to do because you couldn't go very fast and go very far. And our mode of transportation was a mule. We had mule skinners, guys that drove the mules, and then if you got lucky enough to ride a mule. Now, I'll tell you right now, when a mule doesn't want to go very far, he don't go. A mule, he just sits down, and he ain't going nowhere. And so it was very hard to make mules do something. But that was Hunter Liggett, and we did maneuvers out there because they were going to send us over to Italy. In the mountains, in the Alps, I guess. So that's what we did there. And then from there, we were transferred to Camp Carson, Colorado, which is down, well, that's near Denver, maybe, south of Denver. And we were transferred there because, again, it was more mountain fighting and more dealing with the mountains and all that. So after Camp Carson, then we were told we were going to Europe, and we went to Fort Benning first. Fort Benning is down in Georgia, and I wanted to get out of the Army so bad I couldn't see straight. And I saw a line, and I got in the line, and I thought, I said to the guy, I'm in line to get out of the Army. He said, well, not quite. I said, what's this line for? He said, paratroopers. I said, paratroopers? I don't want to be a paratrooper. He said, you better get out of line then, because everybody in this paratroopers is going over the Pacific. And so I got out of line and wound up being back in the Army. From there, after training at Fort Benning, we were transferred up to the PO, Port of Embarkation, which was, I think, up around New Jersey somewhere. And then we got on a troop ship. On a troop ship, for you folks, it's packed with all kinds of people. Nobody knows what the heck they're doing. The food is terrible, and all you do is get seasick. I was seasick so bad I could not. I asked the guy, please put me in the infirmary. He said, what for? I said, I can't eat. I haven't eaten in 8 or 10 days. He said, well, let me get you a cheese sandwich. Cheese sandwich. I want to get off this boat. Well, he said, be calm, sir. So finally we landed, but it took us 3 weeks across the Atlantic Ocean. And the reason is because the German U-boats were out there and they were torpedoing the troop ships. If they could knock a troop ship off, then that was fewer soldiers to fight against for Germany when we got to the war. So finally we landed at Le Havre, France. And I never was so happy in all my life to see land. You know, you don't think much about land. With that, we went to a camp there. It was set up for us called Old Gold. Now they named all the camps there Lucky Strike, Old Gold, Chesterfield after cigarettes. Big deal, right? Today we wouldn't do that because we talk about lung cancer maybe. But Camp Old Gold was where we were set up. And you got to take a shower. You got to eat decent food. And then we had some really good food one day. And I said to the guy, what are they doing? We're going to eat beans. He said, we got a special visitor. Who is it? He said, I don't know. The visitor was Eisenhower. So he came in, And he seemed like a nice guy. He went up and down the lines and shook hands with everybody. And he wanted to know where you're from. And if you said from Abilene, Kansas, he would hug you because he was from Kansas. And so Antioch, Illinois didn't mean much to him. He just said, he saluted and be a good soldier, and that's about it. But anyhow, Eisenhower was there, and after that, we packed up and went on down and entered into combat in France on the German border. The town was called Bitch, which was not son of a, but just Bitch, B-I-T-C-H-E. But in France, it's Bichet, so we kind of cleaned it up a little. So we got into a foxhole there, and a guy was in his foxhole, and I was in the other one. And I said to him, I got a question for you. He said, what did I say? Where the hell's the enemy? I had no idea. And he said, well, I don't know either. But he said, you look that way, and I'll look this way. He said, if we see an enemy, we'll shoot him. I said, okay. Now, here I am in a foxhole with a rifle, and I don't know where the enemy is. Is that war? That is not very good training, right? So we stayed there for a certain amount of time. I don't remember what it was now. That was in Bitch, France. And then we finally moved out. And now I'm a part of the 71st Infantry Division, which was the Third Army at the time. We finally hooked up. We had General Wyman. We had a number of generals. We finally hooked up with a guy named George Patton. They made a movie on him. And I forget who played that part in the movie, Jerry, you remember? Anyhow, he played a good part. But Patton, and then I went to Kentucky after the war, and somebody wanted me to make a comparison between George Patton, the general, and Adolph Rupp, the basketball coach. I said, Rupp was a choir boy compared to Patton. Patton was the meanest guy I ever saw. He knew only one thing, go, go, go. And we kept going so fast and so far, we wound up one night in the German camp. Now, we're not supposed to be in that camp because we didn't know, and it was dark. So all I heard all night long was, halt, who goes there? Was ist los mit du? And I said to the guy, who's he talking to? He said, I don't know. It turned out to be these are the security people there for the Germans, and they wanted to know who was going around. Well, we got out of there, I'll put it that way. But now that was hooked up with Patton, and then we had other generals after that. Now I'm in combat after I got into France, and that was a 1,000 miles from Bitch, France, down to Steyr, Austria. And it was up and around and down, and we're encountering the enemy all along. Most of the time, the enemy was retreating, and the enemy, Germans moved during the day, during the night, in the woods, and we moved during the day. And the reason they moved during the night is so you wouldn't know where the hell they were. And so we were always wondering where are the Germans, but they had already moved on. And they moved on at nighttime. So whenever we moved, then they were a little bit ahead of us. We captured, the figures are in here somewhere, I think we captured like 20,000 German soldiers. And we suffered some losses too. Nothing like the enemy did. My whole idea as we went through all that 1,000 miles, over 1,000, was could I get on a tank? Because it looked like that was a good way to go. I was tired of walking over 1,000 miles and carrying a lot of equipment. And I thought, if I could just get on one of those tanks, then I'd get a ride. It's kind of like catching a cab, right? And as a guy said, do you have any idea what they do to the people on those tanks? I said, no. He said, they shoot them. Count me out then, I ain't gonna be on the tank. So anyhow, that was the story on trying to get on the tank. And whenever we went into the villages, there were snipers, and the snipers were in those buildings, and they had rifles or whatever, and their job was to try to kill people as quick as they could. Anyhow, now I'm going in, I'm getting ahead of myself. I can't remember all those towns that are in here. Fulda, Munchen was Munich. And during the process of traveling through Germany, you begin to learn some words. It's kind of like French. Do you know any French words? S'il vous plaît, if you please. Pardon moi, mademoiselle, and that sort of thing. Now, when it came down to the Germans, it was always, was ist los mit du? Du haben sie Brot, because you were looking for food. And, of course, the guys were always looking for the girls mit der Schlafe mit mir, which is will they sleep with the sleeping boy, sleep with the guy. So you learned enough of the words to be able to get by in Germany. And the Germans were about as bad off as we were. I mean, it seemed like they didn't want to be in the war either. But Hitler was running the thing, and with Goering and Himmler and all the rest of those guys, they could all call what they wanted to. Now, the worst part of that whole thing before I got to Steyr, Austria, was to go into Lombach, Austria, and there's a bulletin out there. And Lombach, Austria had a Holocaust camp. You know, there were, 10 or 12 of those. And the Holocaust camp was Gunskirchenlochen. And I had no idea what was there because in the war, nobody says, no, on your right's a McDonald's and on your left is a such and such place. And you just go. So I began to see these guys coming up the road. And I said to the guy in my platoon, who the hell are these guys? Because they don't look like they're alive. They're so thin. And he said, I don't know who they are. We'll find out when we get up there. Well, it was the Holocaust camp. And these were guys that had left after the SS had pulled out. And when the SS pulled out, which was Hitler's prize and Himmler's prize, like the Gestapo. And when they pulled out, the Germans that were in prison were able to be pulled out of there and be able to be the guys that were in prison. And I'm talking about the Jews and the Gypsies and all of the ne'er-do-wells that Hitler didn't want, that he was trying to get rid of. You see, his idea was to have a supreme Aryan race that would be bigger, stronger than anything. And he epitomized the German who was blonde, 6 feet three, and built like an Adonis. And he even went to the point, as you all know, maybe the book show, where he'd match up those guys with girls and have babies so that the babies were pure Aryan, not Jewish, and to have a supreme race. Anyhow, we got to Gunskirchenlochen. It was horrible.
Do you mind if I ask you additional questions about the experience?
I can't hear you.
I said, do you mind if I ask some more specific questions about you freeing the prisoners?
Sure, you ask anything you want.
Okay. So how did they react when you liberated them? What was the experience like, the reactions were freed?
Of the people that were freed? Well, I'm going to be honest with you, there weren't many alive. The camp had, I don't know how many there, and there were two boxcars. And the boxcars were full of dead people, piled on top of each other. The only thing that they wanted when we were told to open the doors of the boxcar was something to eat. And we were told by the medics, don't give them anything, because if you do, they'll die right in front of you. So we did not give them any food. One guy handed them a cigarette, and the guy ate it, because he thought it was food. And anyhow, the Holocaust was right there in front of us. And like I say, anybody that would try to tell me it didn't happen is crazy. Sorry for me to talk about.
You're fine.
I'll be okay in a minute. At any rate, that was Gunskirchenlauk, and that was one of about 10 or 12 camps. Mm-hmm. And others were Dachau, Buchenwald. I got one here, Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. Now, Auschwitz, there's a lady over here. I don't know whether she was there or not, but she said, you know what was different about Auschwitz? I said, not exactly. She said, that's where Dr. Joseph Engel performed his experiments. I didn't know. I got to look at that book there because I knew about him and I knew what he did. Mm-hmm. And he was always doing experiments with twins and all that sort of thing. So, speaking of twins, Mitchell and Laura are not twins, but they were born the same time. Jerry, right? But the twins, I have twins in my family, my side, I guess I'll put it that way. And that is Patricia and Priscilla Barnstable. I don't know if you know who they are or not. Well, anyhow, they were the Double Mitt twins. Double Mitt Chewing Gum, and went to Seneca High School here. And then, Patricia entered a con, I'm getting off the subject. She entered a contest in South Florida. I forget, the Miss something or other, and she finished fifth. But while she was there, Bob Hope was there. So he sent word that he'd like to see her and her sister. So we flew them to Washington, D.C., and they met with Hope. And then he interviewed them and said, I'm going to Vietnam on a trip to entertain the troops. I'd like to have you girls come. So we also had Lola Falana and Red Fox. Those are names from the past, you wouldn't know. But anyhow, they went on a trip with Hope. Mm-hmm. And after that, they came back to New York and got in with Eileen Ford and did modeling up there. So they gained quite a bit of fame. Trisha's still here, and she runs the Kentucky Derby Eve Party, which has raised $28 million for diabetes. Pretty darn good.
Yeah.
And her sister's in California and helps out too. So anyhow, that's what the twins do there.
Okay.
Back to the war. When the war ended, nobody said, by the way, the war's ended. You saw the people cheering along the street or the highway. And he said, what the hell are they doing? He said, well, the war's ended. No kidding. How come they didn't tell us? We're out now. We thought we were still in the war. Anyhow, so much for the war ending. And that was in Steyr, Austria. And we had a very big battle there. And I thought probably we might have lost some guys. I thought I was going to get killed because as we went across the Steyr River and got to the other side, the Germans were still over. The Germans had a weapon called the 88, which is like a military weapon. And the 88 was a very accurate piece of artillery. They had other weapons too, but that was one that was really bad. And they were zoomed in on the Steyr River where we crossed in pontoons at 4 a.m. in the morning, trying to get to the other side to establish a beachhead, if you will. So we got over there, and I always remember this, the bombs, the shells were coming over, and so one of the guys in my platoon said, we're going to get killed. I said, no, hold it. Dig into the bank. He said, what for? I said, when the shells land, they're not going to hit you if you're in the bank in a hole. So they all did, and as a result of that, a lot of lives were saved at that point. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that you never would think of doing that.
Yeah.
anyhow, that was Steyr, Austria. And we were the furthest eastern U.S. military unit. We met the Russians there. And when we met them there at Steyr, the other side of the river, then, and the war ended, the Russians came over to our side to celebrate. And they were all drunker than skunks. They had been drinking vodka, I guess, maybe all day. And they were firing off weapons and rifles and, oh. I said, who the hell are these guys? None of them spoke English. All they did was yelling in Russian words. So somebody said, well, don't make them mad because they don't look like they're friendly. They're supposed to be on our side. And he said, oh, they might not be on our side if you make them mad. So the net result was we got along with them okay, but it was not what you'd call a nice meeting. And that was when the war ended. So now, after the war, the case gets down to, how can I go home? And you can't go home. You're still on the service. And then all of a sudden, they put us in places to be that were safe, I guess. And Augsburg, Germany was one of them. And Augsburg was okay. Nothing, a real old, everything over there was ancient, seemed to me like. So we were deposited in Augsburg. And with that, they began to start us a program to keep the military busy. And in Augsburg, they started football. And we had some great football players there. And then we had baseball. And I went out for baseball, and I was totally out of my league. We didn't have Joe DiMaggio there, but we had some of the guys like that. And then they started basketball. And since I'd met Allstate in Illinois, I went out for the basketball team for the Third Army. And we wound up winning the European Championship in, I guess, in Munich or wherever we played those games. But that was kind of a great move for me, because as a result of that, one of the guys on the team was from Kentucky, and he said, where are you going to school when you get out? I said, I'm going to Illinois. He said, what about Kentucky? I said, where? He said, Kentucky. I said, where the hell is that? And he said, well, there's a place called Fort Knox. I don't want to go there. I'm through with the Army. No, he said, you're not going to have to go there. But that's where it's no, Kentucky's down there, Fort Knox. So, and that result was that he wrote Coach Rupp a letter and said, I got a young man over here I'm playing basketball with. And this guy's name was Mel Tico. And he said he's gonna be a good player. And I think he could play at Kentucky. So this Rupp wrote him right back and said, well, when that guy gets out of the service, tell him to get in touch with me. And that's what I did. And that's how I wound up here, talking to you guys. Mm-hmm. If I had never written Rupp a letter, I would never have been to Kentucky. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, I told my mother I was going to Kentucky, and she wanted me to find it on a map. Nobody knew anything about it. I said, well, Abraham Lincoln was there once. She said, what's that got to do with me? I said, nothing. She said, Lincoln is a past president, that's all I know, and he freed the slaves. Well, yeah, but he was a good guy, I think. I'm not sure. He come from down around Burksville, Hodgensville. Anyhow, Lincoln was kind of my point of being able to say where Kentucky was, because my mother and all the people in Northern Illinois did not know nothing about Kentucky. And you would think today it would, because of the TV and all the other stuff associated with the networks. But back then, nobody knew anything about Kentucky. And I got in my car. We had a car, I don't know what year it was, and drove to Lexington from Antioch, Illinois, and it took me 15 hours to drive down there. And I checked in the Phoenix Hotel and called Rupp and said, I'm here. He said, good, come out in the morning to the gym and we'll talk to you. So now I get up in the morning and I go out to the gym, which was alumni gym, and there were guys running all over the place. Now that gym held 2,800 people. Rupp Arena holds 28,000, I guess, something like that. So anyhow, I went in the gym and guys were shooting baskets and they're going all over the place. And I met Rupp and he said, well, would you like to work out? And I said, no, I just got out of the service. I haven't done any working out. Well, I said, why don't you work out a little bit? So I called the manager over. I said, get him a pair of shorts and a pair of shoes. And first thing I know, I was out there shooting baskets. And then the guy blew a whistle and he said, U5, play U5. I don't have a scrimmage. So we scrimmaged there and then somebody blew a whistle and Rupp had me shoot some long shots and I'm getting off the subject, you know, I guess about the military. Mm-hmm. Is that okay?
Just a bit, and then I have some follow-up questions.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I'd like to backtrack to when you went to the concentration camps.
Yeah.
Yeah, and ask what the conditions were like. Besides, I know you spoke to the food conditions there, but maybe their living or anything of that nature.
Well, at Gunskirchenlaken, which is right here, mm-hmm. The camp was across the street, and the camp had all the necessary things to get rid of people. I'm talking about mass murder. Go into a building and turn on gas and gas everybody. And then from there, crematoriums or whatever. But where I was the two boxcars were on a siding because it was a train siding. And that's where the inmates were coming into. And so when we were told to open those doors of the two boxcars, all we saw was dead people. Maybe a couple of people alive, raising their hands, looking for help. But they couldn't move. They were emaciated. And there was no way that you could get them up and tell them to get going, go someplace. But they needed hospitalization. And the medical guys there made sure we didn't give them any food and didn't give them anything to cause their life to extinguish. And that was, I don't know how many guys made it out of there. I mean, basically, these boxcars were called 40 and 8s. They'd hold 40 people and 8 horses. That was the name of the 40 and 8. And the boxcars were filled with people because the Germans didn't care whether you... Hitler finally figured out it was cheaper to starve people to death than it was to execute them. And so, therefore, about everybody in those two cars were emaciated. They had not had any food or anything. And it didn't make any difference to them. They weren't worried about whether somebody wasn't well. All they wanted to do was get rid of those people. And all those camps were like that. Treblinka, I think it was in Poland. And then Auschwitz was there too, somewhere up there. But all those camps were designed for some reason was to extinguish life out of those that were not conforming to what Hitler's requirements were. And his requirements were that you're a pure Asian and not Jewish and not Gypsy and not ne'er-do-well or whatever. So you got to say, well, how could that guy get in power? Well, he didn't come in by a vote. Nazis came in 1931 when Germany was in a depression. And you got to think about this country. Whoever had a depression here, look out. Because then a lot of things will rise up and all of a sudden you'll be a minority. And you won't have a vote to do anything. I'm not sure you got a vote today with Trump and Hillary, but hopefully the vote turns out to be positive. Well, yeah, that was the what happened in Germany, and the Nazis were came way out of a path somewhere. But I had some. I don't know, Jerry. Did I still have Nazi flags here?
I don't know.
I don't know either. This is the history of the 71st right here. So if you want to know where we were and what we did, it'd be right there. You can look at it and bring it back.
Right. Also, was this...
What?
I just wanted to let you off. Was this part of your service probably the hardest, seeing those individuals like that?
Was this the hardest part of my service? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure, when I was drafted and went through all the training, that was not easy, but I was, you know, you got, how old are you, 20?
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, back then I was 18, and I was a young guy, and I was strong enough to take about anything and put at me. At least I thought I was. And so, as far as training was concerned, we went through all of that and never considered it to be hard. Older guys, yes. 20-mile march, forced marches were hard. A lot of guys passed out. But from my standpoint, no. But the war itself, and traveling a little over 1,000 miles from Bitch, France, which was Le Havre, basically, and then all through Germany and like that, and ended up in Austria. Yeah, it was tough.
Mm-hmm.
I often thought, am I going to get out of this or not? First of all, how can I get out? Who will help me to get out of here? And nobody. You're in. Now, does it produce nightmares today? I still think about it. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. To know what you've been through. Anyhow, there's some brighter sides to this. I was on it over here. And I won't bore you with these pictures.
Yep. So in what ways did in what ways did those experiences change your life, maybe today, or your outlook of individuals or war?
Well, in what way did it change my life?
Mm-hmm.
I guess probably having appreciation for what people do.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes down to my life was changed dramatically when I went out of high school into the military and no longer had control over what you do. You're told what to do, but you're not having control over it. So you end up suffering from the standpoint of that. My career in the military was successful because I got out alive. And then my career after that, and I went to work for a company here in town. It was okay because I grew up in the business and became a manager and had a lot of people working for me.
Mm-hmm.
So did I endure it? Yeah. Have I got an epitaph? No. But I will tell you right now that if you're going to avoid war, do it. And the war produces nothing. And that's where we are today.
Yeah. Also, prior to entering the war, were you involved in any sort of religious activity?
In the war, in the college? Or
just
in the war?
Throughout your childhood, high school, or growing up in general?
Well, I grew up in a small town, and a Methodist church was our church. When it came down to getting hooked up with any organization associated with religion, though,
mm-hmm.
I did not. I respected everybody that did.
Mm-hmm.
When you grow up in a small town, you know everybody. And it didn't make any difference what their religion is. You know, it's not like today, they say, well, he's Catholic or he's Jewish or he's... they do that today, I guess. But back then, there was no mention of that. When the war broke out with Germany and the Jews were involved because of Hitler, there was a lot of sentiment in my high school about Jewish people. And the guy that headed up our band and music department was Hans von Holweed. Hans von Holweed. And he was German. So the net result was he was well received. But he was a good guy. But right away, opinions are formed, lives change, and there's certain feelings that mm-hmm. are brought out that are not favorable yeah. to people.
Do you think any of your religious beliefs were challenged by the Holocaust and World War II in general?
Do you think that had anything to do with me?
Yes.
Well, yes, it did, because the Holocaust, I did not know it until we came into Gunskirchenlaken. I did not know that there was these crematoriums, gas chambers, and all of that taking place. No, I did not. And then once I found that out, then I formed an opinion. And my opinion was anti-German, anti-Nazi. Not that, the German population went along with what Hitler's regime orchestrated. I mean, Himmler and Goering and those guys were not smart guys, but they got into power. And once they got into power, then they began to commit atrocities to maintain their leadership, I guess I'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. I never felt strongly against the German population, the general population, because a lot of them were very nice. And while I wasn't a big fan of German food, we've got, I don't know if we have one here in town or not. We might have a German restaurant. Well, we used to have one here, I think. Yeah. Go ahead.
And when you returned home, because
do
of
what?
Your, after returning home and liberating these individuals from concentration camps, did people here consider you a hero?
A hero. No, that's interesting. It's a good question. When I went back home to my little town of Antioch, I always remember going downtown, and some guy said, "Where the hell have you been?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I haven't seen you in a long time. What have you been doing?" Nobody knew. The communications back then were not like they are today. Everybody knows where everybody's doing or whatever. So no, I was not a hero. And as time went along, through you folks, filming and other organizations, I've got some here, yes, you've been depicted as somewhat of a hero, I guess. Mm-hmm. Not that you ever thought of it that way. I only did what I had to do because I was told to do it. And not necessarily given a reason why. When World War II started, nobody said we were in war and this is what we're going to do. You just went into the war. And you went into Europe because that's where Hitler was, and he was overtaking Czechoslovakia and Hungary and all the rest of the places over there and massacring people. So that's the reason why we were there, to stop that. I guess somebody must have said, "We got to stop this guy."
Yeah. Were there any individuals? Hmm? Were there any individuals that you did consider a hero throughout your service?
Well, yeah, there were guys in my platoon that lost their life or were injured badly. Yeah, they were, but I can't name all their names. Let me see here. I might be able to find a picture here.
Or did you have any lasting friendships that you can recall?
Well, I did for a while. They somewhat disappeared. Jerry, Tony Leptic, one of the guys in my platoon, he called me Sergeant Barney. But after that, so many of these guys have died, and I don't think I can find the picture in here, but yeah, there's no way I can find that picture. I can go through there and find it. But our platoon had a lot of guys in it. And so, you know, it's a funny thing. It's like life. As you go through life, like I know you folks here, and then pretty soon I'll know of some more new people, and then I'll say, well, who were those people from Center College? And Barbara will tell me, she said, Daddy, that was so-and-so and so-and-so. So you wind up having new experiences and new relationships. Mm-hmm. No, I don't. I like to think that there were guys that I thought were heroes, and maybe they were, but I felt like everybody that was in the service that was fighting for the same cause that we were heroes. Mm-hmm. They were the heroes. You had to have nobody hung the cause out on a flag and said, this is what we're fighting for. You didn't have that. You did what you had to do. You formed an allegiance and a bond with the guys that were with you in the war, and to protect the country, to protect themselves, protect whatever. And that's all you wanted. And then the first thing Bobby wanted, I said last thing, was to get the hell out of the service. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be in the service forever and a day, because there's not a very good ending to that.
Yeah.
It's like today, you read all the headlines going on with us, Africa, or Europe, or whatever. And people go over there and visit and come back and say, it's wonderful. I can't quite buy into that, but it's all right.
Yeah. Do you feel that the enemy soldiers had the same duty or obligation to their country that you had? Or were they fighting for a different cause?
Are you talking about those people in Europe, let's say?
Germans, Japanese, Italians.
Well, the Japanese, yes. The Japanese had, I guess I'll call it a religion, of fighting for their country and protecting their rights. And they would do anything to see, what was hard to understand, that life to us is meaningful. To those kind of people, it was not. They didn't care if they become yell bonsai and jumped into a bonfire. And it was always hard to understand. The bombers, the Japanese that flew those planes would crash to their death to try to bomb a ship. No. I think you have to have a mental attitude of some sort. And I don't think I didn't, maybe others did, that I'm going to do everything I can to save my country, to save this, to save that. I would have done anything I had to do to save the guys with me, protect them. But when it came down to no, we just did not. We didn't have that allegiance, I guess, like you might have the Japanese had. The mentality of committing suicide, which will enhance our program, no. We didn't, not that I was aware of.
I just have a few more questions.
That's okay, keep going.
What sticks most with you about your service? Is there a certain memory that you always recall when someone asks you about the war?
What stands out from that standpoint?
Yes.
Well, I think that the overall picture probably stands out more than anything. The Holocaust camp is a big thing in my mind. When it comes down to where we were and what we did, I guess probably the length of time that it took to do what we had to do. You got to remember that we were over there quite some time fighting the Germans. But they were not easy to find because they traveled during the night, as I told you, and we traveled during the day. And they were not to be found. If you found them, you had to kill them. And so trying to find them was a big thing because they're in their country. You know, if you're trying to find somebody in America, man, you go into New York City and they were in Chicago, you don't know where the hell they were. So you could not know. Go ahead.
The last question, or two last questions. What would you like future generations to remember about World War II, or your service specifically?
What would I like for them to remember about World War II? Mm-hmm. I suppose that specifically, I would like for people to know that World War II was not fought in vain. There was a substance to it. There was a reason for it. It was never explained when we went there. So you had to come up with your own explanation. Why am I over here in Germany? I don't give a darn about Germany. Why are they fighting in Italy? I don't care about Italy. Mussolini and Hitler and those guys. So, and Stalin was another one. Why are we over here fighting here? It's for mankind to try and preserve itself and make sure that we still exist on the face of the earth, I guess. Mm-hmm. Very hard to explain reasons why. You know, I see that nowadays with ISIS and ISIL. Why are they doing that? Why are they beheading people? And it's beyond your comprehension, because the mentality of certain races and certain people is not the same as ours. And our mentality is to make people happy, preserve, give you jobs, earn a living, raise your families. We've got so many good things going for us. And America, is that opened its door, we got 4 million immigrants coming in or something. And then we got Trump says, build a wall and keep the Mexicans out. You got a wide variety of opinions about what should be done to preserve mankind and the goodness of life. I don't know if I answered that question. I probably bounced around a lot.
No, you answered it.
Okay. Well, like the four of you sitting here, you're young people, and you've got to have a chance in life to do the good things you'd like to do and preserve the traditions that are out there and make sure that your families are safe and sound for the future. Yeah. Now, did we do that with that in mind? Maybe so. In a subtle way, you know, you really didn't concentrate on that, but it was there. You know, there are certain things in life that are not visible, but they're there. And the preservation of our traditions, our family lives, and our whatever else, our way of living, need to be preserved. And anybody that tries to destroy that in a wrongful way, there's lots of things done in a right way, but some things are done the wrong way. So we need to be doing that to be able to make sure future generations exist and have a good life.
Okay.
Now, I don't know, I might have bounced around. Did I answer the question, Jerry?
You did.
Okay, did I get an A?
Yes, you did. So they may have some additional questions for you, but I'm going to head out.
Are you going to go?
Yes. It was so nice meeting you.
Where are you going?
Oh, I have to go back to Danville.
Oh, you do? How long does it take you to get there?
It's an hour and a half.
Is it really?
Yes.
I'll be done. You got to go back to class?
I do.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming and good luck to you.
No, thank you.
When do you graduate?
In 2 years.
2 years.
Okay. I actually have a question.
Okay.
Which I guess I can just...
Can you get back? Come on.
I guess we'll play a nice little squiggling around. So you had quickly kind of touched upon kind of anti-German sentiment in your
About
hometown.
About what?
Anti-German sentiment in your hometown. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? What exactly do you remember?
Well, you know, what happened was once Germany got into the war, I guess I'll put it that way, and a small town feeds on lots of stuff that they don't know anything about.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, Hans von Holweg, who was our musical director, a very talented guy, but he was German. Bye. She's gone again. So the net result was that you got the same thing maybe going on here now. I don't know. Not necessarily Germans, but you had the Japanese. There was an strong anti-Japanese sentiment on the West Coast when the war broke out. And then even Italians. Mussolini was in power. Anybody that was in my town that was of Italian descent was put down. So those things get created. It's a funny thing. I grew up in an area where Al Capone was a big deal. You ever heard of Al Capone?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Chicago.
Well, we had Al Capone and Babyface Nelson. And a hero in my area was John Dillinger. Now, John Dillinger robbed from the rich and gave it to the poor. But he also killed a lot of people. So John was not a very good guy. But those are the things that are created by, I guess, the sentiment and mindset or whatever. So the answer to your question on the German, you know, somebody should have taken it out on Hitler, because he was the instigator, along with Himmler and Goering and the rest of them. But nobody really sat down and thought that through. And the media was not available like it is today. Whatever you think, the media is going to influence your thinking. Whether you like it or not, you might think, oh no, I can avoid that. But you are going to be influenced by the media. If you watch TV, you'll know. If you listen to the radio, of course, radio back then was a big deal. And the guy that we had to influence us was Franklin Roosevelt, FDR, with his fireside chats. And we had a list of FDR who was always talking about his wife. I guess she was a good gal. And all the rest of the crew down there in Washington, D.C. But okay, go ahead.
So, post-war, when you came back, were there still lingering ill will feelings towards the Japanese and the Germans in your town?
You know what? That's an interesting question. One of the guys in my hometown was in the Marines, and he fought at Iwo Jima. You know what Iwo Jima is?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that the one where Joe Rosenthal raised the flag?
Yes.
And now they don't have the right guy there?
Yes.
You
yeah.
And somebody said, no, that wasn't him, that was so-and-so, Joe. But anyhow, this friend, a guy I grew up with, fought over there in Okinawa and in the Philippines area. And he hated Japs. He called them the dirty Japs. It was no such thing as a good word for the Japanese in his mind. And you got to say, well, that's because he fought them and they killed guys next to him. The Germans was about the same way, not quite so bad. But that's because the Germans are somewhat distant from us. The Japanese came in and bombed Pearl Harbor, upset the hell out of everybody. But no, I've never had any sentiments about the Germans at all. I think what they do now is the Mercedes-Benz is a good car. And Bernhard Langer is a good golfer on the senior tour. So I'm all for people to live their lives and enjoy their ability to do what they're doing. I don't know if that answered the question or not.
Oh, no, you answered. So, post-war, have you ever gone back and visited Europe or Germany or the places that you went while you were in the service?
Yeah, have we gone back?
No, but tell them about the Olympics. You went back.
What'd she say?
The Olympics. She said that you went back. The Olympics.
Oh, yeah.
What, 72?
Well, in 1948, for whatever it's worth, the Olympics took place. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, the Olympics took place in 1933 in Germany. And Hitler would not recognize Jesse Owens because he was black. And there was another black guy on that relay team, too. But that was kind of the first thing that came out in my mind way back when as racism, I guess I'll put it that way. But in 48, the Kentucky team, five guys, and then with three alternates, I was an alternate, there was eight of us, and then we had two guys that were at-large guys, made 10, 5 and 3 and 2, and then on the other side was the Phillips Oilers, and they had the same five Phillips, and then three alternates, and then two guys at large. And that made 20 of us. And we went to the Olympics in London, England. Now, we won the games. I didn't get to play. That was a bad thing as an alternate. If somebody got hurt, I'd have been in there, but nobody got hurt. So we played and beat everybody. We only had one game that was even close. I'm not sure who that was now. But anyhow, that was the 1948 Olympics.
Hold it. You haven't told them that you played basketball for Kentucky.
What'd she say?
That you played basketball for Kentucky.
Yeah, I was on the basketball team in Kentucky. That's the reason I was over there for the Olympics.
Okay.
And in 48. You're right, Jerry. And the Oilers had five guys on the team, and Bud Brennan was the coach of Phillips 66. Phillips 66 was an AAU team, as opposed to we were a college team. But back then, and nowadays they would send LeBron to the game, even though he's a pro, and they've been doing that regularly. Mm-hmm. We want to win the Olympics, so we send the best athletes, pro or otherwise, to the Olympics and win. Now, we got the Olympics in Rio. McElroy, the golfer, is not going to go. And I'm not sure if LeBron James is going either. He's already been there about four times. And everybody's afraid of going down there and getting bit by the mosquito. And I don't blame them.
But didn't you go to France?
What'd you say?
Didn't you go to France?
Did I go to France?
Yeah, she asked if you went to France.
Did I go to France?
Yeah, when you went over for the Olympics.
Oh, you mean when we went to the Olympics?
Yeah.
Yeah, after the Olympic Games were over, then we went down to...
So you went back to France.
We went back to France. We went down to France. Yeah, down to Paris.
Yeah.
So you were a part of the U.S. Olympic basketball team?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. That's amazing. And how timely. Yeah. Just about, as Rio
starts. I need to tell you one story, if you don't mind.
Oh, yeah.
We went down to Paris, France, for 5 days. Mm-hmm. And the first night there, we go to the Lido nightclub. Now, the Lido nightclub is a very, very sightly club, if you will, because none of the girls didn't wear any clothes. And But it was done in the right way. It was not done in a bad way, promiscuities. But anyhow, I never forget that. They had a guy on the stage there. I'd seen him in New York City. I don't know his name, though. And that guy came out and put an act on, and I'll never forget him, that whereby he ate. He'd look at something and then eat it. He'd tear a page out of a book and eat the page. And this guy's act was that. And he looked at his shirt and he'd tear it off. He ate the shirt. I said, I'd never seen that guy. I saw him in New York, I thought. But that guy was an unbelievable act, if you will, because he looked like he could eat anything he had, but he just, I'm not sure he swallowed it. Anyhow, so much that. And then from Paris, we had some time. We went down to Geneva, Switzerland for the weekend. And I always remember being there. The Lake Geneva was the clearest, coldest lake in the world, but it was pure. And kids were jumping in like it was hot water. Christ almighty, I couldn't even put a hand in there, or a finger in there. But anyhow, that was Geneva, Switzerland. And then we flew back to Paris and came home. We went over to England on a boat and we got to fly home. I didn't like that airplane trip to Paris, I mean down to Switzerland either. I flew a lot in my business career, and I never got used to that. Bad flights just kill me. I'm talking about the kind where you drop 500 feet or 1,000 feet, and oh my God, I had so many of those. It seemed like, because back in those days, air travel was not much better today. Sometimes I read about near collisions and that sort of thing. Anyhow, that was a going to the Olympics in 1948, and we won
them. So you got the gold. So you got the gold?
We got the gold.
You're a gold medalist.
Now, I did not, I need to clarify, I did not get a medal.
Okay.
Because there was three of us that were on the team and didn't get to play. And that's a shame, because we got everything else, but we didn't get the medal.
Yeah.
And the only reason for getting it would be to pass it on to my wife, Jerry, or whatever.
Grandkids.
What'd she say?
Grandkids.
Yeah, grandkids, you're right. So I'll be like that commercial. Grandpa, why did we kill a wolf? You ever see that commercial? And Grandpa says, we never could find him. Well, he was right there, Grandpa. Why did we kill the wolf?
So that's the only time that he went back.
Okay, sorry. I just have one last question. So we have it. So your daughters are the original double mitt twins.
Yeah.
So they did a lot of stuff, Vietnam, like performing in
with
front
Bob
of the
Hope,
troops.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a unique perspective that you have. How do you feel that the veterans from Vietnam are treated in comparison to World War II vets?
You know, how do I feel about what they did?
I didn't go
over there on that trip. They went with Bob Hope.
Oh, yeah, but with just how they were doing stuff in Vietnam, how do you feel that Vietnam veterans are treated with, like, your daughters interacting with?
Well, I think Vietnam veterans deserve to have their rightful place. They performed the military activities that were necessary. But the question you always have to ask yourself, did we really need to be there? The Viet Cong, now, you know, Muhammad Ali just got through with that. I got no fight with them Cong. And I don't know, I'd have to look and study and say, why were we there to fight the Viet Cong? We got North Korea and South Korea. I really don't know why the hell we were there, and I have to look that up. But the military, the guys that went, did it because they had to go. And Ali took the position, I ain't got no fight with them Cong, and that was a religious position on his part. to say, I'm not going to kill anybody. And maybe, you know, he was right. I don't know. It's up to him. It's up to the public to judge that down the road. But he certainly took a position, and a very, very difficult one, and not necessarily a favorable one in the eyes of a lot of people. I often thought, and I'm sure I'm not right, I could have said, I ain't got no fight with them Nazis. And somebody said, we don't give a damn what you think. You're going out to serve. You're going in the military whether you like it or not, sir. Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. That's my story on that part. I don't know if he acted in the right way. And now we're going to name the airport after him. I think we're going a little bit too far when we do a lot of stuff like that, but I'm not in charge, so what difference does it make? Talk to Mitch McConnell, see what he said.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I think that was the last of our questions. I was just filling in for Eliano, but wow, yeah. So I think we're just out of time.
Thank you so much, yeah.
Yeah. What?